What? Oh, yeah, me too. Hi, I'm Earl. I'm an alcoholic. I'm making friends down here. I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to share. It's always an honor and a privilege to do so. I want to thank Tom for coming to get me at the airport. Picking me up in an airport is not a really good job. I hate to fly. So when I get off a plane, I'm kind of shaking and rattling. I'll say hello to the people in closed circuit land, whatever that thing is over there. Do they drink in those rooms, or do they? Can you drink? Yeah. So high out there. Right? Wow. I drank. I didn't start till I was 12. I didn't. That was because nobody offered me a drink till then. But I was restless, irritable, and discontented long before my first drink. When I was just a little tiny kid, I used to sleepwalk and talk in my sleep and scare my parents so things would come out of my mouth. And they took me out and had a bunch of tests run on me. And the answer they came up with was every night before I'd go to sleep, they'd give me a big tablespoon of this liquid stuff, and I'd drink it, and it would knock me out. Solve the problem, no more sleepwalking. And I think subconsciously I got the information very early in my life, if you don't like the way things are going, take something. And sort of file that away for future reference. And when I was 12, they ran some more tests on me and determined that I had a very high IQ. I don't have it anymore, so I'm not bragging. We began the downward spiral on that about 15. My father decided I should go away to boarding school because we needed to get me out of the house and make a man out of me. It's time to become a man. And so they piled me, took some more tests, and I got accepted to this think tank boarding school where they had 250 young men from all over the world. And it was like they scoured the earth to find the most intelligent and disturbed young men they could possibly find. And they put us all on this little campus. And I got in the car one day with my family, and we drove up to this place. And I got out of the car when we got there. My father got out of the car, and nobody else got out of the car. And he walked over to me, sat a suitcase down next to me, shook my hand, and said, "This will make a man out of you," and got in the car and drove off. And it was a turning point in my life. I mean, the fact is that I was being given an opportunity for a wonderful education that has held me in good stead to this very day. The feeling was that I had just been thrown away by the people who knew me best on the planet, and I had no idea why they'd done it. And I'm not the kind that lives here, you know. I come from down here, and it wiped me out. I mean, I was in as much pain as I'd ever known in my life for about 72 hours, which seems to be my breaking point, and it was like something just broke inside me, and I thought, you know what, you don't want me, I don't want you, that's it. And I turned my back on my family, and I never looked back. But I had no tools for living. I'm in this school with these 250 kids. 249 of them are 13 to 18, and I was 12 years old. I was the youngest and smallest kid in the whole school. And I was terrified of everything and everybody. And I was walking around on campus with no tools for living, no idea how to do this, no idea what I'd been thrown away, filled with shame, filled with fear, knowing that my life was just a disaster. And I met Tiny. And every high school's got a guy named Tiny. You know, he weighs 6'4". He's 6'4", weighs 240 pounds, right? He was the biggest kid in the school. And Tiny found me, and he came up, and he said, "How you doing, punk?" And he slapped me in the back of the head, sent me and my books flying. And I had this, like, out-of-body experience, you know what I mean? It's like when you watch yourself doing something, but your head's saying, "It's bad, don't do this." And I walked up to Tiny, and I hit him as hard as I could, which had no effect on Tiny whatsoever. And Tiny looked down at me. I just stood there looking up at this giant person, and he looked down at me and said, "You know what, kid, you got a lot of guts." And then he beat the crap out of me right on the spot. And as I took the beating, I'm thinking, you know, this is going all right. This is not going bad. And the reason was that what was first and foremost in my mind was how terrified I was of him and everyone else. And he had just said, because I'd hit him, he said, "You got a lot of guts." My violence had masked the fear. He didn't know how afraid I really was. He thought I was this gutsy little kid. And that became my first tool for living, violence. When, you know, when in doubt, attack. And that was how I lived for a long time. I'm not a tough guy or a bad guy. I never have been and I never will be. I have been extremely violent in my life as a result of being a very self-centered, frightened human being. And that's all that was about. So, I mean, I went back to my room and I'm sitting in my little dorm room waiting for the bleeding to stop. And word spread across the campus, you know, watch out for this little Hightower kid. He's a maniac. He attacked Tiny. So now I got this reputation that has absolutely nothing to do with who I am. I mean, it's, the hole's just getting deeper as far as I can tell, you know. It's just not going well. And the cool guys started to come around, you know, the other bad guys, right? So Matt came by. I'll always love Matt. Matt came by and he came by to my room and he goes, "Hey, you want to smoke a joint?" And I said, "Well, yeah. Yeah, I do." And I had absolutely no idea what he was talking about. But it didn't matter. I was alone in the universe, and this guy was saying, what I heard was, "You want to come with me?" So it was, "Yeah, I do. Yes, I do." It doesn't make any difference where we're going, what we're going to do. He could have said, "We're going to go rob the local bank. Do you want to go?" I'd have said, "Yes, I do. I want to go." So we went by, and we picked up Steve. And Steve had a Tupperware container full of cheap red wine. No grapes involved. Does that, you know, that fortified stuff. And we went behind the dorm, and Matt fired up the joint and took a hit, and I just did what he did. And, passed it over there to Steve, who took a pull on the wine and handed that to Matt, and, you know, I exhaled, and here came the wine. So I took a hit on the wine and passed that. I have no idea what I'm doing. I have no idea who these people are, where I am, why I'm there, why my family threw me. My life is just a giant question mark. And I have no idea why I'm smoking this stuff and drinking this other stuff. I don't get it. No idea what's going on. All of a sudden, it happened. It happened. The thing that makes me bodily different from my fellows occurred. And just this feeling just kind of came up over me. And I just went, "Hey." Yeah. For the first time in my life, I was comfortable standing where I was standing, doing what I was doing with the people I was doing it with. I never felt that before. And when you've never felt that way, that is a remarkable condition to be in. That this is really, really good. And I didn't know what, I don't know, is it the pot? Is it the wine? Is it the fact that I'm standing here with my two very best friends, Steve and Matt? I don't know what it is. All I know is I got to do this, you know? And I was amazed. I said, you know, here I am. I'm smoking the marijuana thing. I'm drinking the wine thing. I got, you know, I'm hanging out. I'm hanging here. I mean, I never hung in my life. Man, I'm hanging here. Hanging with my brothers here. This is good. I got this, and I'm standing there, and I'm thinking, you know what? I don't seem to be going to jail. No, you know, the guys in the white coats have not arrived. No blood has been drawn. It's all a lie. This is good. And there was no downside to it in the beginning, and I have to remember that, because I got this thing called euphoric recall. That, you know what I mean? I don't remember being strapped to a table and writhing like a dog, but I do remember those lovely moments out behind the dorm. Not bothering anybody, not causing any problems, just having a little. Just going to have a little. And I'm 12 years old, I'm standing there, and I'm feeling this, and I'm thinking, this works. I got to do this. I got to do this as often as I possibly can. There's absolutely no reason that I can see not to. I didn't know that all of those horror stories would unfold as time went on. But in the beginning, it was, why not do this? The fear was gone. This stuff is the fear killer. This stuff makes it all right for me to be on the planet. I got to go with this. And I did. Every day for the next 16 years, no matter what. Which is the difference between me and the problem drinker. You give him a good reason to stop, he actually will. Not me. I don't even touch the brakes, man. I just go. It never occurred to me to stop. Whatever the price was that came along, it was just that was the price that was coming along. And that was the price that had to be paid to do the only thing that had ever given me any comfort in my life. That's just my life, and that's the way it's going to roll, and that's the way I'm going to do it. So it was very humble beginnings for me. A little pot, a little wine, here we go. 13 with pills. The only reason I took a pill is somebody walked up to me at a party and said, "Would you like a pill?" And I said, "Well, yeah." Could see no reason not to. So I took a pill. Two of them, as a matter of fact. 20 minutes later, I was laying on the floor and I was very comfortable down there. And they came by and said, can we get you anything? And I said, no, but could you, what was that? You know, they said, that's two and all. And I went, all right, two and all. And I asked for that by name. That was pretty good. So 13 was pills, any kind of pill, two and all, second and all, Placidil. Ooh. Oh, yeah. That's a beauty. Last time I kicked out, it was like 2 weeks before I could talk. She says, how are you, Earl? Oh, man. 14 was psychedelics. I did about 650 acid trips. Got classified legally insane by the military. A few years later, that's a whole other story. 15, I started shooting dope. And the only reason I shot dope was because somebody said, would you like me to stick this in your body? And I said, well, yeah. And they did, and I just kind of went... And on the way down, all I could think of was, yeah, this'll work. Now, you got to understand something. Here I am identifying as an alcoholic and talking about drugs. Shame on me. The reason I identify as an alcoholic is because that's drugs led me. I'm a child of the 60s. I grew up in the 60s, and we were the drug generation. And I was we were carving out our own identity. Our parents were alcoholics. We weren't going to drink ourselves to death like they were. We were carving out our own identity. We were going to kill ourselves in a whole new way. So we were very, very focused on the drugs. You know what I mean? That's why we... That's what we were focused on. But I got to tell you, you know, in retrospect, looking at my life as a result of having stayed sober and looked at the truth about my life, what I know for a fact is this. The drugs would come and go. They would come and go. I was not committed to any one thing. I am not a specialist. You know, my drug of choice was, what do you got? You know? Because I saw it's all anti-oral medication. It'll all kill the fear. If I can get enough of what you got in my body, the fear will go away. And that's the only reason I'm here. I'm not sober that long, lady. You got to stop doing that. Yeah. Oh. Wow. Flashback, right. I don't even ask if anybody else sees it anymore. Something like that happens, I just kind of go, well, if they saw it, they saw it. I saw it. So, no. I like to think of that as stuff as just a little something extra. You know what I mean? But the reason we were focused on the drugs, I mean, and the drugs, I mean, one day it was heroin, one day it was cocaine, the next day it was a lot, the next day it was whatever, you know what I mean? It was just all floating through. There was only one thing that was on the table every single day, no matter what, and that was booze. Booze was on the table every day. And I believe there's a very simple explanation for that, and that is it's a simple fact in my life, and that is booze is extremely reliable, and drugs are very unreliable. That's the truth about it. I mean, there's no quality control going on the street out there. You have no idea what you've got. You know, you never know. And nobody, it's not like your dealers are these honest people. You know, I mean, I have never gone to cop heroin and had the dealer say to me, you know what? Not very good this week. Come back next week, we'll have something good for you. But I wouldn't buy this if I were you. It never happens. You go get yourself a fifth of Jack Daniels, a quart of gin, you know what you got. You can count on it doing the job. And that's why that stuff was always on the table. I mean, you do so much cocaine, cocaine's exceptionally good this evening. You can't get your mouth open anymore. You've overshot the mark completely. It doesn't matter. You get yourself a quart of gin, suck a little gin through your teeth, it leaves you right up, and you can go back to the party. It's fine. Ask a little too speaky, don't worry about it. Jack Daniels will get you the rest of the way. Get you where you need to get, that heart and lungs working place, that quiet, dark, nothing's working but the heart and lungs. You've killed all the feelings. You just, it's good. It's just a good place. And you can get all that. What gets that done for a guy like me is alcohol. That's what will get it done. Now, I was a child of the 60s. I had to fit in, so I was doing the drug thing. But what I relied on and was alcohol. That's what I relied on. Without even really being aware of it, that's how my life went. So 15, I started shooting dope. 16, I started going to mental institutions. Things started unraveling pretty early. I dropped out of high school. I figured 4 years of Latin was enough. Dropped out of that boarding school. My father came back in my life, says, you've obviously lost your mind. They threw me in a mental institution for 3 months of observation and a year of rehabilitation. I thought that was a little excessive. I tried to escape from the first one. and didn't make it, you know. I didn't make it, you know, because they give you those 3 cups of pills a day. And I, you know, I'm shuffling around in the hospital for weeks, and I don't know what's in the little cups of pills, you know what I mean? I just know that we're not getting high like we should be. I know that. But I got the 3 cups of pills, and I'm shuffling around in there, and I decide one day to make a break, and I'm sitting in the cafeteria, and they got the exit signs like they have here, except they were green. And they had arrows through them, so they were really specific, you know what I mean? You can look at the exit, and you go, I go out that door, the arrow says go that way, so you go out the door and just bank a hard right down the hall, and you'd see another one and have an arrow, and you could work your way out of the joint real quick just by looking at those signs. Nobody knows that, but people who are trying to escape. And I was sitting in the chair in the cafeteria one day, and I decided to blast out, and it was like, ready, 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 go! And I'm hauling ass, you know what I mean? That's all I got. Arms are working, and I can't move, and I'm thinking, you know, my brain's working right, and I can't get the body to work, and I don't know what's going on. And you hear from the nurse's station over the loudspeaker, you hear, Lou, you got a minute? You want to grab her? He's making a break for the door. Lou's over there having a sandwich going, yeah, I'll get him in a minute. You know, I'm working. Tools for living. My tools for living were drugs, alcohol, violence, and run. And I had to add to the list, if you get thrown into mental institutions, you got to get out before they get the Thorazine in you. Because if you don't, you leave them when they say. That's the way it's going to go. So the next time I got thrown in the nut house, I escaped the first day. I blasted out the first day, and I was running through the backyard of this joint, heading for this chain-link fence. I can see it like it was yesterday. I got whistles are going, and there's this guy running, chasing me down the thing, and I'm heading for the fence. At that point in my life, I'm like 16, 17 years old. I'm a high school dropout. I'm an alcoholic, and I know it already. I'm a drug addict. I'm at any moment, hopefully, an escape mental patient. It's just like my resume, you know? And I'm thinking, if I make that fence, I don't have any problems. If I make that fence, I don't have any problems, because I'll be loaded in 20 minutes, man. This is L.A. This is my town. I'll be loaded in 20 minutes, and that's all that matters, because I drink no matter what. No matter what. Given a good reason, I don't stop like the problem drinker. Problem drinker gets another drunk driving, goes before the judge. The judge says, you know what? I'm sick of you. I'm sick of seeing you. I see you again. You're doing a year. Straight county time. You're doing a year. And L.A. County's a lovely place. Doing a year in L.A. County. Not going to talk about it, not going to discuss it. We'll discuss it at the end of the year. Problem drinker hears that. Just been given a good reason to stop. Actually can stop drinking and driving. Me, I start wondering what it's going to be like in jail because I'm going to jail. I know I'm going to jail. I'm going to jail. I'm just sort of grateful for the information, you know. We need to schedule in a year in county. God. I drink no matter what. No matter what. They have this little thing they do in my neck of the woods where they tell new people, just don't drink no matter what, which happens to really piss me off. Because that's like, thank you very much. That really, really addresses what I seem to be up against here. Thank you very much. I'll try that. Next time I find myself somehow magically at a bar, having no idea how I got there one more time, and they say, what do you have? I'll say, nothing for me. I'm not drinking, just no matter what. It's like just say no, you know what I mean? That really grabs it by the throat, doesn't it? I'm the opposite of that. I'm the absolute opposite of that as a result of my alcoholism. I drink no matter what. Given a good reason, I cannot stop. You can say to me, you know, how many times people said to me, drinking's out of line. It's like, then I suggest you not drink like I do. You know, and it was an end there to stop. Anyway, 16, I hit the streets, escaped from the second mental institution. As a matter of fact, since then, I've done business with that psychiatric facility. I've outlived it, as a matter of fact. It's no longer in existence. Sort of like a little Papillon reference there. That's how it feels. I went did business, and I was in a business meeting with the director of this joint, the head guy. And all the way through the meeting, he kept saying, you know, your name is very familiar. I kept saying, this is a familiar name. At the end of the meeting, you know, we conducted the business. Everything was settled. Everything was good. And we were leaving. We'd gotten along great. And I went up to him and I said, you know, I feel like I need to be honest with you. You know, I escaped from here 16 years ago. And he just looked at me for a second, just kind of baffled by that statement. He looked at me and he said, Well, I'm glad to see you're doing so well. Yeah, everything's all right, thanks. Oh, man. So I spent 3 years out on the streets, and I do what you do to stay loaded on a daily basis on the streets. I drank and I used no matter what. That was my primary purpose. I was clear, very, very, very focused on what I was out there to do. It was the only thing that made it comfortable for me to be on the planet. When I was 19, I met this woman. We talked for a little while. It went well, so we were in love. We decided that we would move to Northern California. I got accepted to a prestigious business college in Northern California. We piled all our belongings and 8 pounds of hash in the back of this truck and drove to Northern California. She got a straight job. I became a drug dealer. It was the only thing I had any experience with. I didn't know how to do anything else. I had no morals. I had no ethics. I had no sense of family. I had no sense of community. I couldn't tell the truth to save my life. I mean, there was absolutely nothing inside me that thought being a drug dealer was a problem at all. So she got a straight job. I went and got an adult night school program, got my GED. I'm going to college during the day. I'm studying marketing, production, distribution. My business is booming as a result. I think college is great, you know. I'm 21 years old. I get diagnosed to have malignant cancer. They fly me back to L.A. They do major surgery on my upper back. They tell me I'm going to die. They tell my family I'm going to die. I tell them you have no idea who you're talking to, because the way I was using it at that point was getting pretty insane on a daily basis. The blackouts were starting. I was coming to in strange places. It was getting pretty crazy. They put me in the nuclear medicine program down there. They were giving me, shooting me full of this stuff all the time, and I didn't like the way it was making me feel. I just didn't like it. And one more time, I was dealing with a medical facility, and they didn't know how to get high, as far as I was concerned. So I just quit the chemotherapy, and I went back to my house, and I got loaded the way I get loaded, which was intense at that point. And I beat the cancer thing. It's been a long time. And frankly, I believe that the way I was using them in those days, my body had become so toxic that cancer could not live in my body. So I beat the cancer thing and I kept moving. And I went to, I'm back up in school again, and I'm a junior in college. I got an early acceptance to go to USC Law School. I'm editor-in-chief of my college newspaper. They're threatening to expel me every time my paper comes out because I'm writing these inflammatory articles about this and that and the other thing. I mean, I'm out of my mind. And my mother calls me and says, look, we haven't been anywhere as a family in 10 years. We'll go anywhere you want to go. We got to go as a family, though. We got to put this family back together. And I said, okay. And I flew back to L.A., and on my 22nd birthday, we took off to fly to Mexico. And on the way there, the plane crashed. And my mother, my father, my little sister were all killed. And I wasn't. Well, I was, actually, but I was still physically alive. And I came to on a mountain in Mexico, and my back was broken in 3 places. My skull was fractured. My arm and leg were crushed. I was paralyzed from the waist down, and I was awake. And the only thing I could move was my right arm. And I remember laying there, and it was on this mountain, and it started to rain. And I lay there, and I watched them all bleed to death right in front of me. And I had a little conversation with God. It was the last one I would have for a while. And I said, you know, I have absolutely no interest in a God that would take a kind, loving, gentle creature like my little sister Kimberly and would leave a lying, cheating, thieving, dope fiend, alcoholic like me on the planet. There's no justice in this. I have no interest in you. We're done. And it was just this real calm feeling. And then I laid up there for a while, and some guys came up and they scavenged the plane wreck and took the money out of my wallet and left me up there to die, and left me went back down the mountain and left me there to die. I had no more use for you either after that. I had no love of man, no love of God. And I was out of the game as far as I was concerned. I had no more use for the facade anymore. I mean, I was going to school, so you'd all just kind of leave me alone, let me drink and use the way I wanted to. I'd socialize, you know what I mean, a little bit, be nice and stuff. But I mean, I was never into it. I was afraid of everything and everybody, and I didn't know how to do anything. Didn't know how to be in the world. I'd been underground my whole life. I'd never, ever come up to the surface and just been a member of or a part of a family, a community, a group of friends, anything like that. I'd been addicted since I was 12 years old and then left home when I was 12. So I didn't know anything about how you did. I used to walk by rooms of people and just be absolutely baffled and amazed at how you would all sit around there and talk about stuff. I had no idea what you could possibly be talking about. I didn't understand. And when I was laying up on that mountain, I said, you know what, I'm going to get down off this mountain and I'm going to do what I want to do. So I'm going to drink and use the way I drink and use, and I'm going to do it till I die. It's the only thing that's ever given me comfort in my life, and that's the way I'm playing it. So my right arm was the only thing I could use, so I kept banging myself in the side because it hurt so bad when my back broken that the pain kept pulling me up out of the shock because I knew enough about it. I'd been injured a few times before, other stories. If I shocked out, I was going to die up there. And pretty soon some guys came up and they found me and they put me in a truck and they drove me down to a Mexican Red Cross station and they tagged my right big toe and they sat there and smoked cigarettes and waited for me to die because it didn't look like I was going to make it, and I didn't die. And they finally took me to a hospital and they kept me there for a while under Federale Guard. The Federales came in and interrogated me for 3.5 days through an interpreter. I had military guys with the guns and stuff standing in my room, a bunch of them. It was amazing, like I was going to jump up and kill them all. You know, I couldn't even sit up, you know. And they kept sitting me up, and I just black out because they weren't giving me anything for pain for 3.5 days. And they interrogated me. It was all as a result. They wanted to know why I was back in Mexico. It was another unrelated matter we don't need to get into now. And I finally called a friend of mine up in Northern California whose family was out of Mexico City, and he called his brother, and they flew the company plane in and got me out of Mexico and back up the States, and I spent a long time in a hospital up there. And they told me I have a withered left hand, and I might be blind in my left eye, and I probably wouldn't walk. And none of those things are true. And I came out of that hospital. I got maximum doses of Demerol every 3 hours around the clock because I had a real good story going for me, and I knew how to work it. So they were maxing me, just fixing me up big time. And they don't taper you off in the hospital like that. You know, you spend a few weeks in there like that, and then they just discharge you. So it's like 3 hours and 1 minute after I got out of there, I broke out into a sweat, and I needed to hook up. And I know how to do that, so I did. And I got a lot of money from the airplane crash insurance, the airplane insurance. And I had a big house in Bel Air and a bunch of cars and lots of cash and a basin full of booze and a, you know, storeroom full of drugs. And I went for it. And I went on my last run, and it lasted 4.5 years. And I drew a sober breath on 3 separate occasions during that 4.5 years, and they were for 72 hours each, and that was because I was strapped to a table. I would go to this, I'd get so toxic I couldn't use anymore, and I'd go to this little sanitarium where you give them 150 cash, and they'd slap you on a table, strap you down, shoot you full of anticonvulsants, and let you ride. And when your 72 hours is up, they'd either take you home, you could either go home, or they'd send you to the morgue, whichever happened. And they really didn't care which way it went. These places don't exist anymore. And I used to reintroduce myself to God and say, you know, look, you get me out of this sane alive, and I'll never, ever drink again as long as I live. Man, I can't take this anymore. I'm too beat up. And I'd get off that table, and I'd be drunk that night. Be drunk that night, because I know how to stop. Every time my head hits the table, I'm stopping. This has got to stop. You know, but every time my head comes up off that table, I got a whole new agenda. I got a whole new agenda. It's like, man, I am not feeling good. And I know what to do. I go to my best friend. I go drink, ease the pain, kill the fear. That's all it's about for me. And I got in the last blackout. Just blackouts were the normal fare for me. I've come to in different cities. I've come to in conversations with 4 police officers at a time, having absolutely no idea what were they talking about. Not a fun time. I mean, what do? You know, you just bing, you know, you're there, and there's 4 cops, and they're not at all happy. And they're looking at you, and you just, you learn, you know, you just put your hands where they can see them, you know, and you just nod, yeah. You just start agreeing, man. It doesn't matter what they're talking about, just agree, and eventually somebody will tell you why we're here. That's all there is. I mean, what else are you going to do? Say, excuse me, officers, I just got here. It's this little trick I do. I'm here, I'm not here, I'm here, I'm not here. You just learn how. And I came out of my last blackout, and wrapping it up, when I came out of my last blackout, I was 28 years old. I was 215 pounds. I had hair out like this. I had a beard out like this. I was yellow. I was quite literally dying of alcoholism. Organs were starting to shut down. I had 2 physicians independent of one another tell me, you don't stop drinking, you're going to die this year. You're close. And I didn't really care until I came out of that last blackout. I didn't care. I'd broken 75 bones. I had almost 700 stitches in me. I had been stabbed a couple of times. The violence was extreme in my life. I was completely and utterly alone on the face of the earth. I had no friends. I had no place to live. My family was dead. I had no sense of family. I had no sense of community. I belonged nowhere. I belonged with no one. I burned my life to the ground. And I came to him, both my hands were broken, and I just threw them up, and I said, "Help. Help." And they took me by ambulance to an emergency room. They pumped my stomach one more time. I'd had my stomach pumped so many times I could talk to you while you did it. You'd run the tubes. And they'd say, "How you doing?" And I'd say, "Yeah, it's a bad day." Pumping away. They pumped my stomach one more time. They said, "Get him out of here. He's going to die." I was just a pathetic drunk. And they took me to another place, and they kept me 5 more days. And they said, "Get him out of here. He's getting worse." And they took me to another place. They kept me for 12 more days of detox and 30 days on a free bed. And I learned that if I drank, I would die. And if I didn't want to die, I better go to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I ended up on a Friday night in the basement of a church over in West Los Angeles, California. Walked in the back, sat in the back, arms folded, my best tough guy look on my face. Out of my mind. No idea how to live, how to be in the world, how to do anything. I didn't know how to do anything. All I knew was that there was no way I could tell you who I was, because if I told you who I was, you'd ask me to leave. And I didn't have any place else left to go. So I sat in the back, a completely destroyed human being. And the old timers, they saw the look on my face and they stayed off of me. They knew who I was, and they stayed off of me. And they just said, "Buddy," across the room, you know, "Hey, partner, we're glad you're here. Coffee right over there. There's a seat for you here. Good to see you." Stayed off of me, and I just grunt and go over and get some coffee and just kind of let it splash around in my cup, you know. But every meeting's got a new guy, you know, just caught fire with Alcoholics Anonymous, got about 9 months, you know. All he saw was new guy, you know what I mean? He saw me just, and he came across the room at me with a big smile on his face, which I hated. The smiling, happy guy. Hair all combed, you know what I mean? Everything matched. It was annoying as hell. And he came right at me and he just said, "Hi, my name's Vegas. I'm an alcoholic." And I said, "So what?" "Me too, man. It ain't exactly the highlight of my life. I don't know what you're so happy about. Get away from me." And he looked at me and he said, "Keep coming back." You know, which was real meaningful to me. "Yeah, great, partner. I'll keep coming back. Thanks." About 3 o'clock when I'm losing my mind again, "I'll just remember that you said to keep coming back, and I'll feel a whole lot better." Particularly the fact that you're looking at me like that's got some sort of deep spiritual significance. You know, your little buddies over there were going, "Oh, yeah, keep coming back." Like, they know it, too. "Beautiful. I feel very welcome now. I'm the loser. You all win. You know what it means. I don't. I hate this place." I did not have a positive reaction to Alcoholics Anonymous right off the bat. Which is fine, though, if you're a guy like me, because I had no place else to go. I had nowhere to go. If I had, I'd have gone there, but I didn't have any place to go. And so I just sat in the back. If you're new and somebody walks up to you and says, "Keep coming back," or, "Hey, man, just one day at a time," or "Turn it over." That's my favorite one. Tell a brand new shaking crazy maniac, "Hey, man, just turn it over." Like that's going to do something, right? What the hell does that mean? I'm lost. I've been here an hour. I'm lost. You know, just step up to the plate. Step up to the plate and say, "Excuse me, I don't understand the deep spiritual significance of turn it over. Would you mind expanding on that for me a little bit?" Well, my neck of the woods, if they're honest, about 75% of them would say, "You know what, I don't know what it means either. I came in, they said it to me, you came in, I'm saying it to you. I have no idea what that means." Now, I'm sure that's not true in New York. Where I'm from. "Well, but there's a guy that reads the big book over there. Let's go ask him. Maybe he'll know." So I just sat in the back, and this old guy got up. Old guy, you know. To me, he was an old guy. Now he's a relatively young man. He got up, and he shared his experience, strength, and hope, and he did 2 things that I'd never heard before. It was just amazing to me. He talked openly and honestly about his feelings as a man, about getting up in the morning and his head just chewing on him, head driving him crazy, saying bad, negative things to him as he woke up. And he just took a shower while this was going on, and he got dressed, and he went to work, and he put in an honest day's work. After work, he went and got a bite to eat, and then he went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And having had a spiritual awakening as a result of having worked the 12 steps, he was no longer at an AA meeting to take or see what they had there for him that night. He was there to give. He was there to be of service to the new guy walking through the door, which is the whole point of having a meeting in the first place. And he did that while his head just chewing on him. And then he went home and he got in bed and he pulled the covers up to his head and went to bed. No wreckage. Head chewing on him all day, no wreckage. I was amazed. I had never had a day like that. I was really impressed. And I got to sit back there with that look of disdain on my face and my arms folded, growling at people, keep them off of me, thinking, wow, wow. And then it was like he looked right at me and he said, you know what? I don't care whether you like what I got to say or not. You don't like it? Go to another meeting. I loved this. I did. I loved that, man, because it made it clear to me, this guy's not selling me something. He's sharing it with me. If I want it, I can have it, any or all of it. Doesn't make any difference. If I didn't find anything there that I could use, go to another meeting. Maybe you'll hear somebody there you can identify with. And I thought, you know what? I got to sit back there looking angry and hostile and thinking inside, this is cool. I'm coming back. I like this. This is good. Right? And I got to, you know, get up and huff and walk out the door, go home, get my hour of sleep. You know, pacing around in my little one-room apartment, you know. Get up and try to get tired enough to be able to go sit still in a meeting and go home and get another hour of sleep. I mean, that was what it was like in the beginning for me. I was crazy as could be. And I left that first meeting with something I had not had in years, and which I think is the greatest thing anyone could ever give to a newcomer. And I left that meeting with some hope. I was a hopeless, low-bottom alcoholic. And I had no tools for living and no way to be in the world and no one to talk to and nothing going on in my life. And this guy that I'd never seen in my life gave me some hope. And he shared his experience, his strength, and his hope. And it hit something in me. It hit something in me, and I said, this is cool, I'm coming back. And I waited all week long, and I went back that same Friday night to that same place to hear that guy talk again. And they had a different speaker. Well, I didn't talk to anybody, so I didn't know what was going on. You know what I mean? I thought that was where that guy talked. You know what I mean? And I would go there, and I would hear that guy. And I said, where's the guy? And they said, who are you? And I said, never mind. I don't want to. This has gone further than I care to go already. And this other person spoke, and it was amazing. You know what? I've been coming back one day at a time since that night, since that Friday night in the basement of that church. That was November 6, 1980, and I haven't had a drink since. You guys are just applauding yourselves, you know, because that's got nothing to do with me or my best thinking. I could not get sober for a day. I couldn't do it for a day. I can't get sober, but apparently we can. And that's how it's worked for me. And I stuck around, and I was one of those shadow guys. I ran into a guy last Tuesday night in Los Angeles, and he was a guy named Jerry, and Jerry's got 18 years, and he saw me come in. And I said, tell him what I was like, because the guy I sponsored and the guy he sponsored were standing there. I said, tell him what I was like. And he said, he was the shyest, craziest guy we'd had in a long time back then. He would not talk to anyone. I never took a chip. I didn't take a cake until I was 3 years sober. And I didn't share in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous until I was 2.5. I mean, a word till I was 2.5 years sober. And the only reason I did it at 2.5 is my sponsor said, if you don't open up and get to know some of these people and learn how to trust somebody besides me, you're going to drink and die. Saw you come in. And he was right. He was the only person on the face of the earth I trusted for 2.5 years. And how I got him is a strange, spooky story. There was a film studio that wanted to make a movie of my life. It's another whole fiasco. So I'm sitting in this meeting with these executives, and I'm not sober yet. I'm out there just bottoming out on my drinking, and I've just done enough cocaine to look perky for this meeting. And I'm sitting there, and this lady brings her set designer, and we're having this big powwow, right? And this guy has been working for these people for 6.5 years, anonymously. He's been working with them for 6.5 years in this film studio, and they have no idea he's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That night in that meeting, he broke his anonymity in front of them to tell me that there was a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, and if I didn't get to that organization very quickly, I was probably going to die drunk. And he gave me his card. And all of them just sat there with their mouths hanging open, because What? And I remember thinking, well, that was very nice, you know. A little extreme, but it was nice. And I'm in AA now, and I'm going to meetings, and they said, you got to get a sponsor. And I said, yeah, but you know what I mean? I just don't know if I can do that. I don't know. And I said, well, and this woman said to me, have you ever heard of this guy named Donald Madden? And I got a cold chill came over me, because that was the guy who was the set designer who I'd met a year and a half earlier, who had told me there was such a thing as AA. I thought, man, out of the thousands and thousands of people in Los Angeles that she could have mentioned, she mentions the one guy that I saw out there, that one little glimmer that happened out there. And I thought, wow, that's weird. I'm going home. And I just went home. And I went to my phone book, and I opened my phone book up to the M page, and there was one business card, paperclip to the M page, and it was Donald Madden's card. And I thought, this is getting weird. I better call him. I called him up, and he answered the phone the way he always answered the phone. I'm just ringing, and all of a sudden you hear, Donald Madden! I went, hi, Donald, you probably don't remember me. My name is Earl Hightower. He said, oh, yes, I do. I said, well, I've been going to some meetings, and I thought I could come and see you. He says, be in my office at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, click. And I went there, and I went over to his house, and I sat down, and it was the first time I'd asked anything to anybody in years. And I said, would you sponsor me, please? And just hung my head down and cried. Because it was just felt, you know, it was help, you know, translation, help me, I'm dying. Help me, I don't know how to be here at all. I don't know how to do any of the things I see people doing around me. I feel like an alien on somebody else's planet, and I'm afraid all the time. And if I don't get some relief somehow, some way, I'm going to drink and I'm going to die. And I don't want to, because this old son of a bitch at a meeting a couple of days ago gave me some hope. Now I'm screwed. And he said, I'll sponsor you. You don't have to like what I tell you, and you don't have to think it's a good idea, baby. You just have to do it. And I thought, I can work with that. And we went to a big meeting. He said, they make 550 cups of coffee here every Friday night. You're going to make them for the next year. I said, time out. You don't seem to understand what I'm talking to you about here. I'm ready to kill myself and several other people in the room at any moment. I'm having a very, very bad time. I'm getting about an hour's sleep a night. You would not believe the madness that goes on inside my head. Nor would you believe the volume at which it goes on and on and on. You wouldn't believe it. I'm losing it here, pal. I'm losing it, Donald Madden. I need some help. And your response to me is, make a little coffee. I don't think you get it. And he looked at me and he said, no, you're the one who doesn't get it. Do it or drink. And I just said, you know, there's no talking to you people. I'm trying to have a discussion, and you go right to the drinking thing. Fine, I'll make the coffee. So I go and I'm making the coffee, and I don't put it, and he could have said to me, Earl, let me explain this to you. We're going to do something for you that no one else has ever been able to do for you. You are probably one of the most self-centered human beings I've ever met. You have probably never thought about anything but Earl. Or how this will relate to Earl. You've never thought about it. And we're not going to give you this job because we give the new guys the grunt jobs. We're going to give you instantly, upon walking in the door, an absolutely incredible opportunity to manifest a huge spiritual principle in your life like that. We're going to show you how to manifest this. You are going to make these people their coffee. The coffee's irrelevant. It's just the means by which you get to achieve something you've never achieved. What it's going to do is we're going to let you get out of self. You're going to have to think you're going to be of service. Out of self, be of service to these people. You're going to worry about the coffee pots. Worry that you don't blow out the fuses. Make sure you got the strong pot over there and the decaf over there and the tea over there. And you're going to change the pots. And every Friday night for about 4 hours, you're not going to be thinking about it at all. And when you're done at the night, you're going to feel better. And the relief is remarkable. When you get back to Earl, which of course you will, when you get back to Earl, you will feel better. You will feel better. So we're going to let you do that. And I mean, I would have stood there and gone, huh? He said it to me like a newcomer like me could get it. He said, do it or drink. Okay, there's a clear line there. I got it. I'll go this way. So I made the coffee there for a year. And I did everything that man told me to do. I did every single thing that man told me to do. I talked to him every single day, and I never, ever said, no, I will not do that, to anything he asked me to do for almost 14 years, up until the day he died. I was with that man longer than I was with my parents. He was the single most important human being in my entire life. He rebuilt me from the ground up. I was a completely destroyed human being. He showed me not only how to stay sober, but that I take the principles that I was learning in Alcoholics Anonymous and apply them in all my affairs. He taught me how to be self-supporting through my own contributions and how to go out and get a job. He talked to me about what it meant to give an honest day's work. He told me how what it meant to be a friend and then showed me by being one to me. He introduced me to the God of my choosing because I saw that God manifested in him. And I came to have faith and belief in Alcoholics Anonymous because Alcoholics Anonymous came to me in the form of Donald Madden. He was the one I watched. He was my example of you. And it broke my heart when he died. And my closest friend Christopher called me and said, Hightower, we got to get another sponsor. Donald Madden died July 25th, 1994. And I just said, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to be alive. I don't want to be in AA. I don't want to do it enough. All that, it all came back up on me, and it was I came back to the promise that I made on that mountain in Mexico a few years earlier when I'd said, I will never love another human being again as long as I live, and I will never ever tell anybody who I am. There's no way I'm going to let you love me. I am out of that game. That is not who I am. And I went right back to it for about 60 seconds. And I was driving over, and I met Christopher, and we sat there with Donald, and we waited for him to come get the body. And all of a sudden, I heard Donald Madden in my head. Donald Madden said, you get a sponsor, and you get one now, baby. And as I have never said no to Donald Madden, I said, okay. And I thought this one name just popped into my head, and he was a guy with a lot of time. It's like 32 or 33 now. And I knew that he knew and loved and respected Donald Madden. And Donald Madden knew and loved and respected him. And I called him up, and I said, Al, this is Earl Hightower. Donald Madden is dead. Will you sponsor me? And he said, yes, I will. So I had a sponsor for 3 hours after Donald died. And he remains my sponsor to this day. And it's been a very difficult relationship for me because, frankly, I'm still sponsored by Donald. I can hear him every day, I was pretty depressed about it. I mean, it was hard for me in every area of my life for a couple of years after that. Just now starting to come out the other side. But the beauty of the situation is that coming out the other side, I've learned some things that I wouldn't have been able to learn if I'd have given up AA or if I'd gone and killed myself or drank and died. What I learned was that it's an amazing thing for a guy like me that comes where I come from to have ever loved anybody enough to miss them terribly when they're gone. And it turns out that there's an awful lot of you that I feel that way about. AA picked my pocket like a thief in the night. You took my isolationist ways away from me. You took the barriers and the walls that I put up between my fellows and my God, and you slowly took them away from me brick by brick without telling me, so that when the crunch came and I turned to look for the wall to throw up, I didn't have any bricks to do it with. I was left there having to do the thing that's difficult for a guy like me to do, is feel the feelings and take the next step. It's all the feelings want, is to be felt. Feel them and keep moving. And what's come out of that is that I know for a fact that Donald Madden will never die. Donald Madden is alive and kicking, man. He's in me and he's in thousands of other members of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a couple of my friends here from Rochester, one of whom was sponsored by Donald Madden. And we were sitting before the meeting and commiserating about what an amazing, larger-than-life guy this guy was and what he did for countless members of Alcoholics Anonymous and still does. He's affecting the lives of alcoholics this very day that don't even know they're being affected by a guy named Donald Madden because they've never heard his name and they've never met him. But the guys that were sponsored by Donald Madden, who sponsor, frankly, legions in Los Angeles, are carrying the message that was handed to them by Donald Madden. See, this is my lineage. This is my family tree. I'm a product of Donald Madden. He was a product of Norm Alpin. He was a product of Chuck Sue. He was a product of Bill W. I mean, those are my boys. I mean, that's my line back up that way. And I give it to my, and Britain's a product of me, and Gary's a product of Britain. And we passed it on. And when Donald died, we sat around the campfire, and we talked about it. And I told him Donald Madden stories, and I told him where the message came from. And I go to meetings all the time and listen to these guys get up and share. And I hear Donald Madden pouring out of their mouths, and I just smile. There's Donald again. There's Donald. Doing it again. Doing it again. One of the finest examples of AA ever. Died 23 years sober, carrying a message, taking newcomers to meetings. He used to say to me, read the book, but understand this. Before there was a book, before there was anything, there was one alcoholic down in the dirt sharing his experience, drinking up with another baby. And that's where it started, and that's where it'll end. And he was just this amazing guy. And I love him to death, and I love seeing him. I mean, and that's all we are, is this big, giant tribe. I mean, we all our little places all over the world where we are, is we all gather around the campfire at night, and we share our experience, strength, and hope with each other, and we carry our social history to one another, and we tell the stories and the tales of AA as we sit around the campfires. And every once in a while, a bunch of the tribes get together for a big powwow. We all get together like this, and we all share our experience, strength, and hope, and tell AA stories and carry the verbal history of AA to one another. We got a book that shows us the way as individuals to move. We got 12 traditions that govern us as a group, and we get together and we carry the message, the life and the spirit of AA to one another, and it gives us the hope, and it fills us, and it reconnects us, and it gives us direction and a purpose for life, and we go back out in the world and we have a good time, and we get back together and we do it all. It's the same in LA as it is here, as it is in Boston, as it is in Alabama, as it is all the different places that I go to, and I listen to people talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. It all comes back to the book, which I discovered pretty late in the game for a guy like me. I discovered the book when I was 6 years sober, and I was going to 7 to 9 meetings a week, and I was talking to Donald on a daily basis, and I was sponsoring guys, and I was speaking when I was asked to, taking out 2 panels. I was taking one to the juvenile hall, the beginning of the disease, and I was taking one to County General Hospital, the end of the disease, and I was getting to see the beginning and the end of the disease, and I was getting to remind myself that I really want to stay right in here with these guys. And I was doing that. I was smoking, and I had a job turned into a career, and I had a car and a place to live and some clothes, a little money in the bank. I knew the rent was going to get paid first of the next month, and it was going to happen. And I got a little nutty again. And I went to this old-timer guy, a lot of time, big dude. Went up to him and I said, you know what? I'm getting real squirrely again, and I don't get it. I'm doing everything you guys tell me to do, and I'm getting nuts, and it's kind of hanging with me here day after day after day after week. And this old guy looked down at me, and he smiled, and he said, Earl, saw you come in. You're going to have to get a program, or you're going to die. Go away. I said, excuse me, look at all these things I'm doing. I'm doing this, I'm doing this, I'm doing this. He goes, Earl, it's the fellowship. Vital to your recovery. Glad you have it. But you need a program. You'll find it in the big book. Go away. I said, all right, you son of a bitch. I'll go get a book. So me and this buddy of mine got the book, and we sat down with the book. We started reading the book. We look up, and we went, who knew? This is great. It was this little circle with a triangle on the front of it, right? It's a lovely symbol. It was an ancient spiritual symbol. It stands for mind, body, and spirit, brought together as the whole human being. And therein lies the balance I'm seeking as a human being and have never had, drunk or sober. Alcoholics Anonymous adopted the symbol in its unity, recovery, and service. It's the same thing. The unity is the body. I must bring it here. I can't get sober, but we can. I can explain where I'm at to those people all day long. They will never get it. Not because they're stupid, but because they don't need to. I got to bring it here to my kind. I got to bring it to the ones who get it. When they say, how are you? And I say, I'm all right. They go, come on. Right? They know what that feeble all right means. You know, it's help me. I want to kill somebody. So the unity is the body. I must bring it here. I must stay with you. Every person I've ever talked to that's come back, I say, what happened? They say, well, the first thing is I stopped going to meetings. Got to stay with you. Stay with you. And I do. I'm always with you. The recovery is of the mind, the greater aspect of my disease. It's not about stopping for us. It's about not starting again now. It's about not starting again. How do I keep from dancing with that beast again? How do I keep from going back out there into the madness one more time? How do I keep from doing that? I got to deal with the greater aspect of my disease, the obsession of the mind. The thing that convinces me I can drink like the normal man, which is ludicrous because I got 16 years of hideous experience that says that's not possible for a person like me. But I got a brain that manages to continue to try to tell me stuff like that. Not anymore, but it did. Book tells me that the persistence of this illusion, this belief in a lie that I can drink like the normal man, is astonishing, that many of us pursue it to the gates of insanity or death. I'm that guy. I got to do that. I got to do the recovery of the mind. How do I do it? I work the 12 steps as they're outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what they're there for. That's what they do, is they bring about a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps. The awakening is that I'm restored to sanity, soundness of mind, that I've been relieved of the obsession to drink. I'm perfectly comfortable on the natch. So I work the 12 steps. Step one is, what's the problem? What's the problem? Well, lack of power is my dilemma. I'm powerless over alcohol. My whole life's unmanageable as a result of that one thing. If that's my problem, lack of power, what's my solution? A power. Step two. A power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. The biggest promise in the book, as far as I'm concerned. Well, knowing that, I'll go drink. I know what the problem is. I know what the solution is. I haven't even got off the couch yet. I'm just, okay. You know, yeah, that's the problem, all right. Yeah, that's probably going to have to be the solution because I tried everything I can think of. Well, it says here, well, you better make a decision to do something about this because it is a program of action. All right, so I did step three. I got down on my knees, said the third step prayer, got a little scared, turned my will and my life over to the care of God, got back up on the couch. All right. And then it's like the humor in the book, you know what I mean? And then it says, you know, we hope you were serious about what you just did, right? I'm paraphrasing. It's like, great, now you tell me, right? Like I'm buckled into the roller coaster and I'm just past the crest and here we go. They're saying, I hope you really want to do this, like you got any choice at that point. So I said, well, you know, you can drink here too if you like, but if you don't want to, we suggest that you immediately embark upon a plan of rigorous action that's going to bring about the solution that we've suggested in step two. I said, cool, what do you want me to do? 4 through 9. All right, let's go. 4, did a fearless and thorough searching, fearless moral inventory, right? 4 columns on resentment, fear, sex, looked at my part in it, didn't appreciate that part. Wrote all this stuff down, glaring patterns in my life, glaring patterns. They actually let someone else in the house at this point. I mean, I haven't left the house yet. Here comes a guy in the house, supposed to read this before God to another individual. Okay, read it to Donald Madden, read it in his car, finished it and called him up, said, it's finished. He said, well, we'll get together Tuesday. I said, no, it's finished. Now. He goes, well, I got to speak in Eagle Rock. I'll pick you up. So we're going to Eagle Rock, and I'm reading this, my fifth step, in the car on the way to a meeting in Eagle Rock. I'm reading, I can't believe I am saying this stuff out loud to this man. He had to pull the car over twice. I thought I was going to throw up. I was bad. And we were sitting in this little hamburger stand having dinner on the way there, and I'm reading this stuff away, and I'm nervous, so I'm loud. And I'm reading, and go, okay, and then I resent this guy, and this guy, and people are getting up and moving away from us at the deal, and he's loving it. He thinks this is wonderful. He says, Donald, man, look, they're leaving. Wonderful. And the first direction he gave me when I was done, he said, we don't kill people in Alcoholics Anonymous one day at a time. I said, I can do that. That's a good start. No murdering. And we get to the meeting, and he says to the guy, and I'm as vulnerable and exposed as I have ever been in my life. I'm standing here, when there's a guy, I have just told a guy things I have never told anybody in my life, and he's standing there smiling at me, like he's so happy for me that I've taken this step. And we get to the meeting, and they say, Donald, we're glad you're here. And we see you've brought the first speaker. And he goes, yes, that's him. And I just kind of look up. Horrifying moment. And he loved it, man. He loved it. He goes, oh, look, he's petrified. And it just kept going and going and going, and all the amazing things in Alcoholics Anonymous happen. All the life stuff that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous happens. As you do this stuff. I got through 6 and 7. I hooked it back up with God in 6 and 7. I hooked it back up with you in 8 and 9. Notice that 3 and 4, 4 and 5 me, 6 and 7 God, 8 and 9 you. They review it in 10, 11, and 12, same order. 10 is me, 11 is God, and 12 is you. So I got nobody else to play with. 10, I got to, let's remind you, Earl, and they let me out of the house for 8, and actually at 9, really to be around other people for the first time. And there's a great deal of conversation in the Big Book, if you'll notice, about that, because they want to be very, very clear before they let somebody like me out of the house. armed with this sobriety thing, and I got it real clear. I leave the house, and I'm very, very sorry. Here's your money, and go back in the house. Don't get into all that other stuff. Stay out of all that while I'm on this spiritual journey, and, you know, I know that you're proud. I'm just, you know, I'm sorry. Here, it'll be $20 a month for the rest of my life. I hope that's okay with you. Then you go back in the house. Ten, I keep my side of the street clean, and when I'm wrong, promptly admit it. I take care of my... If I'm doing that, it's very difficult being me. It gets loud in here a lot. I'm a full-time job. If I'm really working on keeping on my side of the street, I got no time to be on yours. What you're doing is none of my business anyway. No need to be over there. 11, I seek God. It's an action step. How do I seek Him? Through prayer and meditation. What do I pray for? Knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. That's it. No more deals. That's it. And why do I meditate? To quiet the mind so that when the answers come, I can hear them. 12 is the third side of the triangle, the spiritual aspect. Having had a spiritual awakening is the result of the steps. That was the whole point. I can practice these principles and carry the message. And that's how I deal with other people. I come from a place of how can I help rather than what do you got for me. Not because I'm a good guy, but because I want to stay sober. I do it because I want to stay sober. I sponsor people, a lot of people, because I want to stay sober. I get on airplanes and fly to Buffalo. Because I want to stay sober. You got to bet, you got to figure with my history, to get my ass on a plane and fly me into Detroit, which was, by the way, was not a lot of fun yesterday because it was bumpy up there. And that plane was jerking and pitching and I was losing my mind. I mean, I've been shot at, I've been stabbed, I've been through it. And I have nothing ever made my palms sweat. This does. Flying in a plane makes my palms sweat. And nothing's ever done that to me before. And then I had to land again, but I wasn't here yet. I had to land in Detroit, which means you got to go up again. And they told us before we left the ground, they said, you know, it's going to be a real bumpy ride. So they were going to suspend service and just get us here. And I'm sitting next to like a 70-year-old Catholic priest. Sorry, Father, but I was thinking this guy ain't going to be enough. And when that thing started bucking and rocking, and he ordered his red wine, which pissed me off. And I said to him, I said, you know, this really frightens me. Thinking, I feel a little better. And he looked at me and said, well, just don't think about it. I said, it's a little difficult under the circumstances, because when I look outside your window, I see nothing but grayness, because it's like fog, and we landed here, and I was a mess, and I'm shaking, and I meet Tom, you know, and I didn't know Tom, and Tom didn't know me, and we hooked up, and I've had a good time here, and you got to know I love Alcoholics Anonymous to get on a plane. You got to know, nothing else gets me on a plane. Last year I did 27 times I got on a plane and flew someplace and spoke and went back. I did 18 this year, I'm cutting down. I got like 16 scheduled for next year, some for 98. And the reason that I do it is I made a promise when Donald died, is that when people ask me to go share my experience, strength, and hope, I'm going to do that. And I'm going to tell them there's people like Donald Mann in the world, carrying the message to people like me. People like me that have never been of any value to anybody on the face of the earth ever. Hopeless, low-bottom, hope-to-die, dope-fiend alcoholics that don't have a shot in hell. Have never thought about anybody but themselves and have never been of any good or done any good or been of any value to anybody. And there's guys like Donald Mann that reach out their hands because that's their job in AA. They don't get into how many times you've been in and out or how much money you got or what you got to say or whether you smell good or whether you look like you might be a fine, upstanding citizen in one day or whether you've been to prison or not or no matter what you've done. If you got an honest desire to stop drinking, they stick their hand out and they say, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, let me get you a seat and a cup of coffee. And they save lives. And some of us do like they did. Do like they did. Follow the example of men and women like that. And we get to stay and we get to have lives beyond our wildest dreams. That's what's happened to me. I get to be in rooms with people like you. I'm actually comfortable standing where I'm standing, doing what I'm doing with the people I'm doing it with because of the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my new sponsor says, oh, all you got to do is get in here. Just get between those. Just get right in there. Get right in between them. If you can get in there, you're in the moment. You're right here, right now, doing what you're doing with the people you're with, actually with them. And if you can do that, you're in the moment. If you can do that, you have a life. It's the only place you're going to find your life. It's the only place you're going to find a God. It's the only place you're going to find any love. It's the only place you'll ever be able to give love. It's the only place you'll find any dignity as a man. And the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous is that if you do the things that are in... This thing goes so far past not drinking and using. It's unbelievable. Out there, the first time I got loaded was the best thing feeling I ever had in my life. And I chased the tail of that dragon no matter what for 16 years. And as it went on, the high got a little lower and the price I paid for it got a little higher. Till in the end, I was paying a terrible price just to try to get well. That's all it was about. In here, I worked hard, man, to get that first 30 days. By the way, I have more respect for a 30-day chip than any other anniversary in Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's an example of a state of grace right there. As I've stayed here, it's gotten easier and easier to stay here as I've done the things I'm supposed to do on a daily basis. And the buzz I get from being here on the planet, living my life, getting to be Earl, feeling the moment, it gets higher and higher every day. Which suggests to me that there's more love ahead. There's more peace ahead. There's more gratitude ahead. There's more of a sense of family and community and connectedness ahead for a guy like me. So that says to me the buzz is up that way. I got to keep going. I got to keep just putting one foot in front of the other and doing the thing that maybe some days doesn't seem convenient and maybe I don't want to do. I just keep moving that way. And amazing things come to pass for a guy like me if I just stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had it all backwards out there. I thought if I came in here and I did the things you said and I loved you, you would love me. If I showed you respect, you would show me respect. If I was honest with you, you would be honest with me. I found that that's not the reward for doing those things. It's not out there. You loving me or being honest with me or showing me respect will not make me happy. You cannot make me happy. It's a decision and a choice I have to make for myself. And I get to make it every day. Am I going to have a good day or a bad day? And I can decide to have a good day. And no matter what happens, it happened during a good day. What I found is that if I love you and I show you love, what I get is I get to be a loving man. If I show you respect, I get to be a respectful man. If I'm honest with you, I get to be an honest man. It doesn't have anything to do with you. It has to do with my decisions or how I'm going to live as a man. I get to choose that today. And I had no choices before I came here. My day was planned when I came to. Every single day, no matter what I thought or how I looked at it. In here, it's all different. If you be new and you're in a room like this and you identify with anything I'm talking about, I don't care. Are you a black woman, a gay man, 65 years old or 14 years old, or Hispanic or Asian or rich or poor, whatever. If you identify with me, we got a common bond between us. And all that other stuff that we use as a, coming from a place of fear to separate us from one another suddenly disappears like that, and all of a sudden we're just two people standing in a room, and the distance between us doesn't separate us anymore. It binds us together. And we got a common bond. And we can move forward with that. So if you're in the room, I love you. I love you as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous loves another member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love you like a drunk loves another drunk. If you're in that little camera right there and you're sitting in that other room, I love you too. If you're new, stay. Stick around. Experience the magic that goes on in these rooms, all right? And I wish you the thing I think is hardest for any of us to find ever. I wish you peace. Thanks. All right.